Hi, this is Ben Trefney, news director at KALW. We're in a membership drive right now. You can support what we do. More than 70% of our funding comes from listeners like you. Please go to donate at kalw.org, click it, and keep these stories coming. Thank you.
KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in downtown San Francisco.
I'm in the Mission.
Oakland, 33rd and Telegraph.
Coming up, we'll see how massive chemical companies impacted farming in India, leading to large-scale migration to California.
We sprayed it with so many pesticides, it just dried up.
Unearthing the Green Revolution. Then, is veganism really accessible to everybody?
When there aren't the resources so that people can actually feed themselves and their family in that way, then it goes beyond just individual choice.
Plus, musician Tao Nguyen talks about a new documentary that captures her first ever trip to Vietnam.
The process of fully embracing all parts of my identity makes this film really important.
We're sharing with you today on an extended edition of Cross Currents. Stick around. In 2015, the former Deputy Chief Minister of Punjab, India, Sukhbir Singh Badal, wrote a Facebook post that went viral. He wrote, "I want Punjab to be like California. I know it cannot be done in one day, one year, or even 10 years, but I'm sowing seeds." His father, the former chief minister, was asked about this at a press conference.
Punjab nu California banan di gal kiti
banai ja rahe kare
nahi tusi kya si
dekho tusi gal suno.
The reporter says, there's been talk of making Punjab into California. The chief minister replies, we are making it California. In response to this, Punjabis on social media started posting pictures and videos of poor infrastructure in Punjab. Flooded streets, unrepaired roads, children crossing train tracks to get to school, villages with no access to water, and writing hashtag Punjab California underneath. They were collectively trolling the Punjab government. Some even put up road signs in their cities saying, "The Chief Minister's California, 0 kilometers. But jokes aside, this idea of California as a model for Punjab has deeper roots. KALW's Kavalroop Kaur Singh picks up the story from here.
3535, combination 35.
The weekly farmers market in Milpitas, California is bustling. Dozens of small farmers are here selling their fruits and vegetables to passersby. Ku Yang is one of them.
$1.70 for this? This is yours, right?
He farms with his family on 6 acres in Fresno. Ku's farm is small, as are most in California. But it's the large-scale industrial farmers who grow most of the state's food. In fact, California was a pioneer of industrial agriculture. Carl Sauer, a geographer at UC Berkeley in the 1960s, pointed out that the Green Revolution was attempting to export the Californian model of agriculture to places like Punjab in India. I've been reporting on farming in the two states, so I ask Ku if he knows of any Punjabi farmers in Fresno.
There are, but the funny thing is they're more the professional ones, the really big ones that do like the orchards and the almonds and the peaches where they do industrial ag. I've seen a couple Indians, Punjabis, there doing that. Small little farmers market, not as much.
California produces over a third of the vegetables and two-thirds of the fruits and nuts consumed in the U.S. If California is the produce basket of the U.S., then Punjab is the grain basket of India. The main crops are wheat and rice, but most of the Punjabi farmers there are nothing like the Punjabi farmers in California. That's what I find out firsthand. I'm in a grain market in Chandigarh, the capital of Punjab. Workers are sweeping wheat into a mound and feeding it through a processor. A farmer from a neighboring city, Gurjant Singh, watches silently. He's just sold 45,000 pounds of grain. But he says his business isn't going so well. I haven't been able to save anything, he says. I'm just barely able to cover my expenses. Using fertilizers and pesticides has become really expensive for farmers in Punjab, especially when it turns out they don't work. 2 years ago, farmers in the cotton-growing belt were growing BT cotton. BT cotton is a pest-resistant, genetically modified seed produced by Monsanto, the U.S.-based multinational corporation. In 2015, after whiteflies devastated Punjab's BT cotton crop, a new pesticide called Oberon was marketed to farmers by another multinational corporation, Bayer. But farmers say the pesticide failed. Sukhjeet Kaur remembers. First, we had a lot of cotton, she says. We sprayed it with so many pesticides, and when it was supposed to be ripe for picking, it just dried up. I'm surrounded by a group of elderly farmers in Begelere, a village in the Bathinda district of Punjab, at the center of Punjab's cotton-growing belt. Bathinda is in one of the regions with the highest cancer rates in the state. There's a train that departs each evening from Bathinda called the Cancer Train. It's filled every day with patients seeking cancer treatment in a hospital 200 miles away. I ask the villagers if there's a cancer problem in their village. A farmer named Bajitthar Singh answers. At least 10 people in our village have it, he says. Then everyone begins to talk at once. One man, Bola Singh, speaks up above the rest. The people here are so poor, he says, we can't even afford to get tested. So we don't even know if we have cancer or not. The villagers say they think pesticides are the reason for all the cancer in the region. I ask if they can show me one of the pesticides that they use. They bring me a blue and yellow spray can with a picture of the sun shining over a bountiful farm. It's a fungicide called Tilox, manufactured by Axis Crop Science, an Indian pesticide company. On the back, it says, "Danger, keep away from people." It lists the active ingredient as a chemical called propiconazole. I find out later that propiconazole is listed by the US EPA as a possible human carcinogen, meaning it could cause cancer. Where can people go? How can they get tested for cancer? Asks Bola. Even if they go, no one listens. Only the wealthy get treated, not the poor. A few days later, I visit a pesticide factory in Derabasi, a city in southern Punjab. The factory is owned by Pioneer Pesticides, an Indian pesticide company. Yashbir Singh Mann, the coordination manager, tells me to put a hospital mask over my nose and mouth before we go inside. He doesn't put one on, though. He says he's used to the environment. The factory floor is large and open. Two giant chemical tanks stand in one corner. Workers in an assembly line bottle and package pesticides. Some of them aren't wearing gloves or shoes. I can smell the chemicals through my mask. After about 20 minutes, we go back outside. I'm relieved. Yashbir flips through the manual that details the provisions of the Insecticide Act, outlining the Indian government's regulations on pesticides.
There are very strict guidelines to use these products.
He says pesticide companies are required to file reports detailing how much product they've sold in order to comply with regulations. I ask him, is it possible for a company to lie in the records and say they sold less than they actually did so they aren't penalized for their extra profit? He says, it is possible. There are some differences between the U.S. and India in the way pesticide use is regulated. In the U.S., farmers are required to report to the government how much pesticide they use. But in India, there's no such requirement. This means farmers could easily use more than the recommended amount without consequences. The farmer has no responsibility to tell the government how much of our product he has bought, he says. The farmer only goes to the government when he has a problem with a product. That's what happened when Bayer's pesticide Oberon didn't kill whiteflies on cotton plants. Corporations such as Bayer often subcontract with local Indian pesticide companies to have their products made. Multinational companies have been in India since the beginning of the pesticide industry, says Yashbir. There were no Indian companies in the field until later. They started up slowly and followed the multinationals. Yashbir says this trend began with Bayer around the 1980s. Bayer began as part of a German conglomerate called IG Farben. During World War II, IG Farben ran its own concentration camps and conducted experiments on Jewish prisoners. After the war, IG Farben was split into multiple companies, including Bayer. Bayer started to make pesticides and herbicides. Today, it is one of the largest distributors of agricultural chemicals in Punjab, with about 20 distribution centers across the state. Recently, Bayer announced that it would pay nearly $70 billion to buy Monsanto, another major player in Indian agriculture. Monsanto and Bayer would not speak with me for this story, but Monsanto's sustainability report says that it is working with Indian farmers to increase production sustainably. It also explains how Monsanto has engaged in philanthropy in India, preventing snake bites and child labor, helping build toilets, installing solar panels. But there's no mention of working with the farmers whose BT cotton crops were damaged, or with families of farmers who had committed suicide, a growing problem in Punjab. Chemical companies hold a lot of power in Punjab, but a small percentage of farmers are not buying in. Barminder Sharma is using a hoe to uproot the weeds on his 11-acre farm. Out of the many farms I've seen in Punjab, this is the first one where I've seen a hoe and not just a tractor tilling the land. Barminder's farm is organic. It's in a village called Sunam in the Sangrur district of Punjab. Sangrur was once lauded as a great success in agriculture following the Green Revolution, but today it has one of the highest farmer suicide rates in the state. At the end of the day, we lost more than we gained, he says. We may have produced more, but our quality went down. We lost our soil, our water, and our youth, who are committing suicide today. Before he became an organic farmer, Barminder was a lawyer for 12 years. Then he decided to return to his ancestral land and begin farming. Initially, it was difficult. He had to learn how to replenish the soil with natural nutrients. Barminder opens the lid of a giant black barrel. Inside is a mixture of cow manure and yogurt that is fermenting. He says this was how farmers would fertilize their fields in the old days. It's what he uses to keep the soil healthy, so he doesn't have to rely on the market for seeds, fertilizer, or pesticides. He's also in a cooperative where farmers loan each other equipment instead of buying their own. He uses WhatsApp groups to sell his crops. He reads an order that just came in.
1 kg kadu, 1 kg pindi, 1 kg karela.
That's squash, ladyfinger, and bitter gourd. Barminder also grows peppers, eggplants, peanuts, turmeric, rice, lentils, and wheat. We go into a mud hut that Barminder built on his farm. He meditates here every day. I ask him what he wants people to know about Punjab. Our Punjab is sick, he says. We need to take responsibility for that. What will we say to the next generations after we've destroyed the environment and consumed all the water? How will we face them? Barminder works closely with Kheti Virasat Mission, an NGO that encourages organic farming. According to them, less than 1% of Punjab's total agricultural land is being farmed organically. In California, it's actually about the same. Less than 1% of California's farmland is organic.
And this is how you take it to the sheller. Mm. The sheller, they take this off.
Back in California, I'm cracking open nuts with Sandeep Singh, a Punjabi almond farmer on his farm in Tracy. He left Punjab in 1997.
They're really good.
Yeah, they taste pretty good these days.
Sandeep is a conventional grower, not an organic one.
How come you didn't want to be organic?
Because when we bought this orchard, it was already 3 years old. It's I didn't plant the trees. It was already planted. So it was already too late to go organic. If you want to go organic, I guess you have to start it from the beginning.
I think Sandeep's answer is a metaphor for the dilemma that the farmers of the world face today. What do you do with the orchard you've inherited? You didn't plant it. You didn't develop it. Yet you must find a way to make it bloom. For Cross Currents, I'm Kamalroop Gaur Singh.
That story was made possible in part by the International Center for Journalists. It's the third in a three-part series exploring the roots of California's Punjabi farming population. You can find all the stories at kalw.org and click Cross Currents. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. When he was 16 years old, Bryant Terry became vegan. It raised some eyebrows in his black southern home, where traditional dishes were meaty and butter-fried. He's made food his career. Today, he's a chef, an author, a food justice activist, and the first ever chef in residence at MOAD, the Museum of the African Diaspora, curating exhibits about food and culture. He came over to our studios and we chatted about his food philosophy and why he says veganism is still seen as a diet of the elite in this country.
My first meal that I prepared for the whole family, I think I might have been around like five. Yeah. For what I remember, it was a disaster. But I think my parents, I thank them for being so encouraging and eating it anyway.
What was the meal?
It was something like, I don't know, like cheese toast and sausages and some salad greens. It's very crude and simple, but.
Not for a five-year-old.
So, yeah. So I feel like I'd be remiss if I didn't talk about the way in which my family connected with food. You know,
yes.
A lot of the ways in which we often kind of celebrate, you know, eating locally and seasonally and sustainably and, you know, growing our food at home. That was just a practice for my family out of, you know, necessity in many ways. When you think about my grandparents being like working class African-Americans who came from the rural South, moved to the urban center, Memphis, Tennessee, and then brought with them many of the survival techniques and practices of living, growing their own food, making meals from scratch, canning, pickling, and preserving. You know, these were things that both sides of my grandparents did. And, you know, looking back on that, it's interesting how so often with the popular media, we can celebrate these things when, you know.
As a trend, as a current trend.
As a trend, or if you have like young, college educated white kids in cities who are doing the things that, you know, people who've been living their lives have been doing for a long time. And so I say that to say that, you know, it's important that we recognize that so many of these practices that are often elevated are, you know, things that we can look at, you know, just a couple generations ago were just everyday occurrences. We can look at, you know, recently arrived immigrants who continue to hold these practices and grow food from their homelands and make their traditional foods and, you know,
try
making meals from scratch.
Try to slaughter the goat in the backyard.
Yeah, you know, all of that.
And I don't know about that one, but.
But it happens. That type of stuff happens right in Oakland. You
go, so. We won't say where.
But, you know, growing up and eating a very diverse omnivorous diet, and then in high school hearing this hip-hop song, and I always think it's important for me. You know, this is my little political intervention around the vilification of hip-hop and just like kind of remembering that period when I was...
What hip-hop song?
Well, the song was called Beef by the rapper KRS-One and Boogie Down Productions.
Beef. What a relief. When will this poisonous product cease?
KRS-One was talking about factory farming. He was talking about the impact of factory farming on animals, on the environment, on human health. Drugs to make the cow grow quicker. Through the stress, the cow gets sicker. And for that analysis, you know, for me as someone who didn't know anything about these issues, that was kind of this political awakening for me around food issues. There it is in your local supermarket, red and bloody, a corpse neatly packed. I went into this period of being whatever your stereotype of the most self-righteous, dogmatic, judgmental, finger-wagging, on the soapbox haranguing vegan. That was who I was for a period.
What was your family's reaction?
My family's reaction, I mean, they were supportive. I think it was hard for my immediate family. I always tell this story about my mom bringing a chicken home, and I think I threw it in a garbage can. And she got wind of that, and she took it out and washed it and said, we're going to have chicken, and you aren't. But
yes, Mom.
I got smart, and I think the next time she brought some type of animal home, I, like, you know, took it in the backyard and buried it in the backyard, and that didn't go over well, especially with my dad.
No.
That was a rough evening.
You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba, and with me today is Chef Bryant Terry. He is the chef in residence at MOAD, the Museum of the African Diaspora, and author of Afro-Vegan. So those are your teen years. Mm-hmm. What happens after that?
I guess the kind of move into really committing to working around these issues as an adult happened when I was in grad school. I was just becoming more aware of what was, you know, happening. Like, food justice is one conversation, but I think we need to understand that we're looking at this kind of food apartheid in this country, where under-resourced communities often have just very few ways of accessing healthy, affordable food. And you go to affluent communities that may not be a mile away, and then it's a whole different world. And I remember there was this chain supermarket in New York, and I had gone to the one in Lower Manhattan near NYU, and it was just like, you know, a gourmet specialty food store, 9 different olive oils and all types of, you know, beautiful produce. And I went to this same chain in one of the outer boroughs. I think I might have been in, like, the Queens or somewhere out in Brooklyn. And it looked like, you know,
the corner store.
It really looked like some type of, like, war-torn, you know. I mean, it was just, like, canned goods everywhere. The few fresh food items that they had in the store were probably things that you and I wouldn't want to eat or feed our children. And so that's when I started to be more aware of, like, these structural realities that people are dealing with, and how it's one thing to, you know, say that individuals should be eating more healthfully and, you know, having more of a, you know, plant-centered diet. But when there aren't the resources so that people can actually feed themselves and their family in that way, then it goes beyond just individual choice. And
right.
That's when I had to really think about just the bigger issues around public policy, really think about bigger issues around, you know, just kind of like corporations and the way that they interact with communities. And so I went to cooking school with the express purpose of founding a community-based organization that used cooking as a way to engage young people around the political issues of food. When you improve the quality of a community as a whole, naturally, and there have been studies that show the health of those communities improve.
So let me give you some ingredients and tell me something really nice I could make for the
family.
Okay,
I like these type of challenges.
Asparagus, potatoes, penne pasta, go.
Well, I would find some fresh parsley, maybe some basil, and I would make a pesto. And in lieu of the Parmesan or whatever type of hard cheese that's typically used in a pesto to kind of give it that kind of unctuous flavor, that richness, I'd use miso, which is a great replacement for kind of giving it that feel.
Okay.
And then I make a nice pesto, and then I would take the asparagus, I'd blanch that in some salted boiling water for about a minute or so, just to kind of take the edge off, brighten the color, but not overcook it.
Okay.
I want it to be al dente. I'd cook the pasta till al dente as well, and then I'd toss both of those in the pesto and have like a delicious penne pasta with asparagus
and the potatoes.
Pesto. And the potatoes, I would probably not have them with that meal.
Ooh.
Because of, I don't want to like overdo okay. it on the carbs in one meal.
Okay.
But what I would do for the potatoes for the following day.
For the following day. Okay, so no two starches in the same meal.
Yeah, I'd cut off the starches, the two in the same meal. But I'd take those potatoes, I would boil them until they're just fork tender, and then I would smash them as one would do plantanos in the dish on tostones, the dish that's eaten in a lot of Latin American countries. And then I'd like toss them
skin
in olive oil.
Skin on.
Mm-hmm. Then I'd like toss them in a little, I'd sprinkle them with olive oil, a little salt, and then cook them in the oven until they're crispy. So you have these like nice, crispy on the outside, soft on the inside, delicious, oily, a little bit of salt potatoes.
Oh, that sounds so good. So thank you so
thank
much
you.
For being here.
Thank you for having me. I love
Absolutely.
You. I love this station. I love what
thank
you're doing.
You.
I was just a couple weeks ago at W. Kamau Bell's Kamau Right Now. And yes, you're a treasure for this community and for
thank you. Thank
everyone
you,
who can listen online.
That's James Beard award-winning chef Bryant Terry. He's also chef in residence at MOAD, the Museum of the African Diaspora. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Tao Nguyen is known for her music. She's led her band, Tao and the Get Down Stay Down, for over 10 years. NPR and Paste Magazine picked her last album, A Man Alive, as one of the best albums of 2016. But this year, Tao has a movie coming out. It's called Nobody Dies. Director Todd Krolwick documented Tao's travels with her mother, Nan Nguyen, in Vietnam. This was Tao's first ever trip to the country, and Nan's first time back since she left as a refugee back in 1973. Tao spoke with KALW's Nina Gensler-Debs about opening herself up for such a personal project. You'll hear a short clip from the film first.
Personally, it is sort of beyond the scope of poignancy what this means, that I could be a first-generation Vietnamese-American. Coming to this country for the first time, but in a lot of ways returning, feeling that I'm returning. And then to, for the first trip, to be with my mom. Excuse me, this is so strong.
Tell me about how you made the decision to let someone follow you around with a camera for that experience.
Well, the decision was easy enough because the filmmaker, Todd Krolwick, is a great friend of mine, an old friend, and he actually made one of our first music videos way back. I didn't know what exactly would come of the footage, and I didn't intend that it would necessarily be made public. It just was such an important, momentous event for our family that I wanted it documented. And we were already discussing a collaboration, be it some kind of music video or whatever, for the new record that was going to be coming out. And so this trip was a part of that collaborative project. And I wasn't even, you know, when he sat me down for interviews, I wasn't really intending to talk.
When you two came to the decision that it was, in fact, going to be its own sort of standalone narrative documentary piece, can you talk to me a little bit how that felt or how you came to the decision that, yeah, that was, in fact, the best use of this kind of footage?
Yeah, I didn't necessarily want it to happen. In the end, the thing that I couldn't deny was that I wanted a tribute to my mom to exist. And when Todd and I were discussing it, we decided the framing and the lens of it would be my love for my mom and a tribute piece to her history and her character and her sacrifice.
She worked so hard. She worked like 17 hours a day with this laundromat. You can see her hands still. They're super wrecked.
like she has these like crazy patches of dry, sort of rashed, you know, like really wrecked skin on her hands. I always used to look at them.
When you introduced the idea to your mom, was she super stoked? Did you have to talk her into it? I mean, she's really funny and she's really feisty and is like so expressive facially during the film, but we don't hear her speak so mm-hmm. much. How did you feel about being a part of it?
She doesn't know exactly what it is. And she didn't know throughout our trip, we didn't know what it was going to be. It was just, maybe Todd had a better idea. She is camera shy in a way. And I think that what my mom really wanted and what my family was so excited about when they saw Todd and the DP showing up was that it would be this documentation of our trip and that relatives. At that point, my grandmother was still alive, and one of my mom's greatest intentions and greatest priorities was to bring back footage to my grandmother, because she hadn't been back to Vietnam in decades as well.
Is there a particular moment that stands out, either performing or, I guess, being documented? Like, is there something that really viscerally comes back to you when you think about the trip?
It was just the smaller, more casual things, like seeing my mom haggle with a street vendor, or watching her ask for directions, or ordering for us at a restaurant. All these things were, you know, my brother and I, we grew up in Virginia with them, and that was sort of always our job, was we had to translate, or we would be the ones sort of representing the family in public. And it was so incredible to see my mom just so at ease and so confident, and she had this swagger, which I had never seen before. And I don't think I could have seen it unless we were in Vietnam together.
And so your mom hasn't seen it yet, has she?
She has not seen it yet. The premiere is the first time she'll be seeing any of it.
And you're going to get to see it with her.
I guess so. Yeah. I'm chuckling uncomfortably because I don't know how she's going to react to all the emotional stuff, you know. And it's in our family, it's not ideal. You know, it's not ideal what I do for my job, how open I am about things. But it's a whole nother dimension to have it on screen, on a giant screen. But I hope that she'll be able to see the love and respect behind it. Not to say, I wasn't grieving.
I'm speaking with musician Tao Nguyen about Nobody Dies, a documentary that follows her and her mother's first trip to Vietnam together. You've spoken before in different interviews and spaces about being wary of being labeled or otherized by your Vietnamese heritage. So I'm wondering, when you decided to embark on this project, did you feel that same trepidation about this? How did that sort of fit into how you're feeling about mm-hmm. how you're characterized as an artist?
You know, now I'm all in on my ethnicity. When I was growing up, I didn't see any Asian American women in the arts or in music in particular. Not to say that there weren't any. I just had a pretty narrow window of what I was paying attention to and listening to. But within that range, I didn't see myself represented. And that can go one of two ways, I guess. You can either really embrace the opportunity to be the representation you didn't see, or you can hope that doesn't matter. The way you look doesn't matter. And I guess my instincts at 22 were to gloss over those parts of my identity. But that's not realistic, and it hasn't been. And I could see right away that the way I was being received was heavily informed by how I looked. I could see it in really racist reviews of records, really outlandish, outrageous things. It was a UK writer, and he said, judging from her name, you might have been thinking she was in a foxhole waiting for the Tet Offensive, but she was working on a record. So when I'm saying that there are elements of of my visual representation that cannot be denied, that's what I mean, is that however much I wanted my music to speak independently of what I looked like, it wasn't going to happen. I think I've grown up a lot, and the arc of my career has been such that the process of fully embracing all parts of my identity, and especially my heritage, makes this film really important to be in, to be sharing. That makes you a millionaire.
That was musician Tao Nguyen speaking with KALW's Nina Gensler-Debs about Nobody Dies, a new documentary featuring her and her mother. It's premiering tonight at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, hosted by the Center for Asian American Media, and it will be broadcast on PBS this fall. Spring and coil for cover now, though the wind does whip us over, it's still summer sun. So now we'll hear a story inspired by a question from you, our listeners. Here's KALW's Nina Gensler-Debs to tell us more.
This is a Hey Area short, where we give bite-sized answers to questions you ask. Richard Goldman wanted to know,
was there ever a railroad that ran from downtown San Francisco to Glen Canyon? And in Glen Canyon, was there ever an exotic animal park or zoo?
KALW's Jesse Rhodes has the answer.
Back in the 1880s, if you were south of Twin Peaks, it's probably because you were a milk rancher. But if you caught the real estate bug and had cash to burn, you might see what Baron Yost saw, a chance to make more money. Yost bought 200 acres of land in what is now Sunnyside. And to make the land more enticing to buyers, he connected the area to downtown San Francisco with the city's first electric railroad. So to answer your first question, Richard, yes, there was a railroad that ran from downtown to Glen Canyon, though technically you had to walk the last 500 yards. Enter Archibald S. Baldwin. Baldwin buys land in the area and, along with another developer, devises a plan
of developing a pleasuring ground and zoo.
That's Evelyn Rose, founder of the Glen Park Neighborhoods History Project. And when she says pleasuring ground, it's not what you think. It's actually an old word for park or open space.
Rhesus monkeys, cudge monkeys, white monkeys, rat-tail monkeys, pigtail.
That's only part of Baldwin's shopping list for the zoo, which was nicknamed the Monkey Ranch. But some financial setbacks and many monkey puns later, the most exotic animals that appear to have made it into the zoo were two emus, a peacock, and a big baboon. So to answer your second question, Richard, yes, there was an exotic animal zoo in Glen Canyon. And it was there until 1922, when the zoo was sold to the city for about $45,000 and became what we know today as beautiful Glen Canyon. In Glen Park, I'm Jesse Rhodes for Hey Area.